Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to this special edition of Battle Lines with me, Venetia Rainey. It's Monday, 15th of April, 2024. In this special episode, we're going to drill down into the unprecedented Iranian attack on Israel that happened over the weekend. I'll be speaking to our Middle East correspondent, Natalia Vasilieva, who's based in Jerusalem. We'll be answering, why did this attack happen? Did Iran achieve what it wanted to? And crucially, does this mean full-blown war in the Middle East? First, let me start with a quick catch-up on Saturday night's events. As the Telegraph's weekend foreign editor, I was actually in the office finishing off my pages for the Sunday Telegraph when we started to get some quite odd news coming in. First, Israel announced that it was closing schools for 48 hours. Then we heard that Jordan was closing its airspace for several hours. And then we started to see early reports of hundreds of drones being launched from Iran. As a paper, we were already on high alert for a possible Iranian attack following multiple warnings from the US. So, of course, we had a plan in place. We immediately scrapped our front page, we started again, and over the next few hours, we scrambled to cover a very fast-moving situation, both online with our live blog, and we rewrote the second edition of the paper. Very quickly, the reports of an army of drones being sent to Israel were confirmed, and then it emerged that cruise and ballistic missiles had been launched too, as well as rockets from Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. As we went to press around midnight, the first footage started dropping of air raid sirens wailing over Jerusalem as missiles were intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome defence system. I'm going to bring in Natalia now. Natalia, what was it like watching all of that unfold on the ground in Jerusalem?
I would say that it was definitely expected, but I would definitely say that this is not something you can be prepared for. I was here for October the 7th attack, which took me by surprise as well as everyone. And I've seen what it's like, you know, I've heard the sirens. And even though I went to sleep around 1 a.m., having heard that the Iranian drones are on the way, I was still, of course, shocked by the sounds of explosions that woke me up. You know, I went to bed at 1 thinking that, you know, I would be better off getting some sleep and waking up early in the morning to be ready to work. Whereas, obviously, there wasn't much for me to do, you know, late at night. And we've heard a lot about the fact that Iran was not going to target Jerusalem, that Jerusalem is a divided city between the state of Israel and Palestinians and the occupied West Bank. And obviously, Jerusalem is the place where Al-Aqsa, one of Islam's holy sites, is located. So it would be really strange to expect Iran to target that. Despite all of that, I heard explosions at 10 minutes to 2 in the morning. They sounded very loud. To be honest, it sounded like it was something a couple of blocks away. And I live a couple of blocks away from Benjamin Netanyahu's residence. So in my worst nightmares, I thought, you know, what if one of the bombs dropped just a couple of blocks away from me? After that, I heard an air raid siren and a couple of more interceptions after that. My understanding was that, and that was proven by the intelligence we have seen since, that a swarm of drones, which was moving sort of eastwards from Iran through Iraq and Lebanon, was about to cross the Israeli airspace, and they would be crossing it from the east. And basically the sirens went off as they detected a target flying towards Jerusalem. And my understanding was that Iran was not aiming at Jerusalem, but at the same time, you know, the sirens went off. Some of my neighbors ran downstairs for a basement. I myself didn't do that because I was pretty sure that, you know, we would not be directly targeted. So I just found a safer place in the apartment away from the window, sort of sitting close to it, to the wall. And yes, we definitely heard a couple of interceptions nearby. So apparently a couple of drones were taking down before they would reach anywhere close to the coast, close to Tel Aviv or any strategic areas. And it was done. And the following morning, what was it, Sunday morning, which is the first working day in Israel, it was the most typical ordinary morning I've seen. I went out for a walk, sort of thinking that, you know, things would look a bit different, that they would look something like Israel in the first week after the Hamas attack, because I remember how deserted the city was. There were no cars. All of the cafes were closed. Very few grocery shops were open. Businesses were shut down for days, if not for weeks. But when I went out on the morning after the attack, it could not have been more normal. You know, I had been taking pictures and videos the day before, sort of to show how you know, life went on in Jerusalem in spite of this imminent threat. And I didn't even bother to take the pictures on the day after the attack because it looked just as normal as the day before.
And what do you put that down to? How do you explain that?
Well, as someone who has lived here for seven months, I think I'm beginning to understand this attitude. Israelis are used to rocket attacks from Hamas, attacks like that. Depending on how old you are and how long you have lived in this country, it's likely that you have experienced things like that and you would take your own security assessment. And obviously, by the time everyone woke up on Sunday morning, they saw that the attack was over, that there was no significant material damage, that there were no casualties except for one girl who was injured in a Bedouin village in the north. And it was clear that there was no there was no immediate danger, so people could go back to do their own things, you know, riding buses running on time, drinking rosé at cafes. So, people just went on with their lives, just like they did after October the 7th, although with a bit of a delay, obviously.
Because I guess from outside, this is completely unprecedented. There's been a very long-running shadow war that you've written extensively about between Israel and Iran that's been going on for decades, but Iran has never attacked Israel directly. And whenever Israel has attacked, we believe, targets in Iran directly with assassinations, it's never taken credit for it. It's always been, you know, denied. It's always been a bit more suspicious. This was obvious. This was Iran sending hundreds of drones, rockets and missiles at Israel. You would have thought people on the ground would be a bit more scared.
Exactly. This was unprecedented on the part of Iran. And this was very unusual in scale. And the response and the success in fighting off this attack was also unprecedented. Israel has managed to shoot down something like 99% of all of the incoming drones and missiles. And, you know, when you look back at what generations of Israelis have went through, I mean, they have been sporadic rocket attacks from Hamas. But with Hamas, we're talking about clunky, low-technology rockets, which are typically very easy to intercept, that do not cause catastrophic material damage, that do not cause the damage on the scale that we are seeing daily in Ukraine, for example. I started looking back to see if there was anything in recent memory that Israel has seen, and I came across reports from 1991, which appears to be the last ballistic missile attack on Israel, and that was the time when Saddam Hussein's Iraq launched 42 rockets on Israel. So that was over three decades ago. And at that time, there was quite significant damage. Those 42 ballistic missiles damaged 4,000 buildings. And two civilians died as a direct result from missile attacks. So the scale of the destruction is absolutely incomparable to that. So I imagine a lot of Israelis, having remembered that, they see that, you know, they basically had an easy ride and they were very lucky with what happened on late on Saturday, early on Sunday.
We should also talk about the role of Israel's allies in intercepting a lot of these drones and rockets and missiles. The US, the UK and, interestingly, Jordan played a really crucial role in stymieing Iran's attack, didn't they?
Yes, absolutely. And for people who have lived here in Israel for a very long time, the role of Jordan was particularly stunning because Israel and Jordan did not have diplomatic relations until the early 1990s. And it was only in 1994 that Jordan and Israel signed a peace treaty. And I saw quite a lot of comments on social media yesterday that I was quite moved by when people described sitting in their air raid shelters with their parents and saying that their parents' generation could remember sitting out air raids in basements in the 60s and 70s, sheltering from Jordanian missiles, whereas now they were actually protected by Jordanian forces. And a lot of commentary I've seen attributes that to the diplomatic efforts that Israel has taken, not to the muscle flexing that we've seen in the past 6 months, but to sort of quiet, unexciting diplomacy work that laid the foundation for that to happen decades ago. And now, thanks to that, Israel was protected.
And what do we know about the UK's role?
Well, we know that British planes have taken part in shooting down some of the missiles. I think it's quite an interesting fact that neither the UK nor the US gave any dates and figures about what and when they shot down. I've heard anonymous reports saying that Israeli Air Force has shot down the vast majority of the drones and missiles. But one could imagine that, you know, the UK and the US maybe wouldn't want exact figures to emerge because, you know, maybe they will show that the US and the UK shot down the majority of the missiles, of the ballistic and cruise missiles, which would have been the most devastating. But they definitely played a big role. And I think it we're not going to know until much later how big that role was.
So what do you think Iran was hoping to achieve? Like, what was its thinking behind this attack? And do you think it's achieved it?
Yeah, the whole circumstances of launching the attack were very bizarre. As you pointed out earlier, we basically knew it was about to happen hours before that. I remember getting an alert on my phone around, 8, 9 in the evening, saying that Jordan will be closing its airspace around 11 p.m., which was the surest sign that the attack was about to happen. And all of those circumstances lead us to believe that Iran has warned everyone in the region well in advance about what is happening. And it looks like everyone in the region knew when it was happening to the dot. They knew exactly when that would happen, which brings us to the conclusion that it looks like Iran wanted to project strength. It wanted to sort of show off its arsenal, to show how much of a capability it has. On the other hand, it looks like they did not really mean to cause a devastating damage that would trigger a blown out war. But it looks like it may have been opportunistic in the sense that because they launched a barrage of drones well ahead of the missiles, they were probably probing the Israeli air defense, for sort of research purposes to see how it works, in case they need to go to war with Israel later on. And it looks like they were trying their luck to see, you know, if they can penetrate the air defense, and maybe if they could, you know, the missiles would follow and cause greater damage. But overall, the attack, although it was it was unprecedented in scale, obviously, it did look quite choreographic and staged, in the sense that the Iranian regime clearly saw the need to retaliate and to make everyone in the region see that, you know, it will not leave the attacks as the airstrike on the Iranian consulate on Damascus unpunished. And it definitely achieved that.
Yeah, we should quickly remind our listeners that the reason we were all sort of bated breath and waiting for an Iranian attack is that on April 1st, someone we widely believe to be Israel, although they've never taken responsibility, bombed the Iranian consulate in Damascus, killed multiple people, including one of the IRGC's top commanders, General Mohammad Zahedi. So we've been waiting for this revenge. Do you think Iran feels like it's made its response clear? Is this the end of the matter? Will it have satisfied hardliners within the regime?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't remember the last time I've covered any conflict or any escalation elsewhere where one of the parties was so crystal clear that they were done, that they did what they wanted to do, and they would like to stop there. We have seen multiple messages and messaging from Iran on that part. I think the first was the Iranian envoy to the UN, who literally sent a message to the UN General Assembly, I think, on the night of the attack, saying that we basically launched whatever we wanted to do and we're going to stop at that. So at least on their part, they're saying that, you know, they have taken the revenge and they would like to stop it there. Whether this is the end of it, obviously remains to be seen, because we still haven't seen any response from Israel. And as far as we understand, the decision has not been taken to respond or not. Obviously, there is no immediate response, sort of a quick retaliation that would have followed within 24 hours. That did not happen. But we're still not out of the woods yet here, I think.
What are the options available to Israel? There are splits in the cabinet right now about how to respond, aren't there?
Yes, absolutely. And options are vast, starting from bombing out Iranian oil facilities, Iranian nuclear sites, bombing military sites in Iran, to more indirect attacks that Israel has carried out in the past, which might include targeting Iranian assets, military sites, personnel in places like Syria and Lebanon with significant Iranian presence. I've heard about a possibility of striking Iranian ships. There was something that I saw in Israeli press this morning. I mean, I've seen reports of a possible cyber attack. Apparently, on the night of the Iranian assault, there was a discussion at the cabinet about basically incapacitating Iranian power grid remotely, as far as I understand, and causing a blackout in Tehran. All of those options are on the table. I mean, there was also speculations about a vast intelligence network of Israel that, you know, it could cause some damage from inside the country. So there are things that Israel can do without starting off a World War III. But yeah, it looks like we're not going to know until much later. Right now, we're talking on Monday and there's another cabinet meeting convened as we speak. So they might come up with a decision or they might further postpone it.
What is your sense of what is the most likely way that the next week or so will unfold? I mean, I guess the big question is this the beginning of World War III?
Well, I have to say, on a personal note, I'm much more calm compared to 24 hours ago. I think that what would have caused a massive regional conflict would be an Israeli retaliation in the immediate aftermath, and something that would not be well thought out in terms of possible consequences. I think the longer it takes for the Israeli government to respond, the more thought out that decision would be, and hopefully will take into account possible consequences. And from where we're sitting, I mean, it's been over 24 hours since the attack, and we've seen influential voices in the government, including the defense minister Yoav Golan, including Benny Gantz, one of the ministers and the most popular politicians in the country, who could be hawkish on any given day. But what we've heard from them so far is an acknowledgement of Washington's support, an acknowledgement of Washington's very clear position that they do not want this to escalate, and they would like to Israel to hold off and refrain from a very harsh response. So right now, I would bet on a delayed response and on something symbolic, on targeting something outside of the Iranian borders.
I guess the final question that we should look at is, what does all of this mean for the war in Gaza?
That's a very good question. I would say the world basically looked away from Gaza for the past, in the past 3 or 4 days, whereas it's nowhere near being over. I would say that if there's one takeout for the war of Gaza, it looks like if there was a chance to persuade Benjamin Netanyahu from going ahead with his planned offensive in Rafah, this might be the best chance that the U.S. government had to dissuade him of the idea, because obviously what Sunday showed is that, yes, Israel has enviable air defense capacity, but it would not have been able to fight off this attack if it wasn't for the American support. And sort of as a token of gratitude for that support, it would totally make sense for Israel to call off the offensive on Rafah. So I think it's quite possible that this war is going to drag on, but we are not going to see an offense on Rafah ever, or at least in the foreseeable future.
Is there anything else that you want to mention that you think hasn't been reported on this incident or we haven't talked about?
Yeah, I just followed the story about the actual damage that some of the stray Iranian missiles did in Israel. And I mean, it's not widely covered in Israel for the obvious reasons that, you know, there's a picture of victory in Israel because no one has been hurt. No one has died except for the wounded Bedouin girl. There's no devastation at all. But there were a couple of hits at two air bases. It's hard to say if it was good luck or if it was something to do with the missiles that one of the air bases which was hit, there were several missiles that landed there, but it appears that it did not damage the main runway. It did not damage any of the fighter jets except for a cargo plane. But, you know, it still shows that whatever you do, whatever enviable alliance you build to fight off this massive barrage of missiles, some of the missiles are still going to penetrate. And obviously it was quite a sensitive site, that Netivot air base in the Negev Desert for Israel. So whatever defense you build, you know, it's not a 100% sort of guarantee against any attack and damage.
Thank you so much for joining us, Natalia Vasilyeva, our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem. This episode was edited by Lillian Fawcett.
That's all for Battle Lines this time. Please join us again next week for more of The Telegraph's best foreign reporting. Goodbye.
Battle Lines is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our news, analysis and dispatches from around the world, subscribe to The Telegraph or sign up to Dispatches, which brings stories from our award-winning correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a live blog on our website where you can follow updates on Israel and Gaza as they come in throughout the day, including insight from contributors to this podcast. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Battle Lines on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it really helps others find the show. As disinformation is a particular problem during conflict, we are relying on your support more than ever. Battle Lines is part of wider Telegraph foreign coverage in our podcasts. If you're interested in finding out more about the war in Ukraine, you can listen to our sister podcast, Ukraine the Latest. Battle Lines is produced by David Degahi, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.